This week, my son Connell will be writing the bar exam. He's presently getting ready to answer a whole lot of complicated questions. He graduated from law school at UBC in April and will soon, we hope, be practicing his peculiar profession amongst an unsuspecting public. And yes, he's already getting acclimatized to the burn of lawyer jokes, of which there seemed to be a fair number. Who knew? Yeah, I knew. Already, I have some sense that he's growing wary about answering that question, you know, so what do you do? Because there's just hazards to admitting publicly to some professions, at least I find. For example, I think it must be a real challenge to revealing yourself publicly to being a physician, you know, a medical doctor. Say you're at a social event, you know, and I have a hunch that after they reveal their profession, conversations all too often shift to various aches and pains and how terrible someone's experience was of X or Y or Z hospital, or being asked an opinion of a folk remedy for some various ailments. And this is kind of, it just goes with the territory, I guess. I suspect there are similar challenges for, say, being in policing or working for the Canada Revenue Agency. And I honestly cannot imagine what it must be like saying that you hold public office. For me, I've discovered that, over the decades, that admitting to being a clergy creature comes with some associated weirdness. I always pause before answering the question, so what is it you do, from the person sitting beside me on the airplane? I do treasure their expression when, after I have revealed my clerical status, they realize that they are now stuck beside me for hours. There's that glorious look of terror that crosses their face, worried that I might haul out some large leather-bound King James Version of the Bible, a handful of colorful tracts, and start saying, "So, my friend, what is the state of your soul? Do you know the Lord? Let's talk." For 8 hours, you know. One of the things I've noticed about those who don't back away from me is if they've encountered some venomous reptile, or those who quickly seize on this opportunity to explain to me why they've chosen not to attend church, which in all seriousness can sometimes be the beginning of a really interesting chat. It can actually be loaded with opportunity. But I have noticed if the conversation goes on long enough, questions get asked. Questions that, you know, might not be asked elsewhere. Certainly they wouldn't be asked of the professions that I've previously mentioned. And I've detected at least three types of questions that get fielded. First, there are those hard but sincere questions for me to grapple with. Then there are the others which are hard but sincere questions that probably should be addressed elsewhere. And then third, there are the trick questions. Our questions really reveal a lot about us. And now I certainly appreciate those hard but sincere questions, though they're usually asked in less overt ways. Why is there suffering is a most common one. Further to that, there are the character of God kinds of questions. Like, how is it that a God who is supposed to be all-powerful and everywhere and wholly good, well, how can that God exist in the light of human suffering? That is a really excellent question. Another related one that comes up is, why is there evil? Also a vexing issue. And does life have meaning? And sometimes, why should I even keep on living? These kinds of questions and conversations, they have weight. The answers can be deal makers or deal breakers. People's faith and future can depend on them being fairly engaged. And I and others I know, we try to take them quite seriously. Then there are those sincere ones that are probably best addressed elsewhere, like, how was the universe created? You know, was it 6 days like we read about at the beginning of the Bible? Or is it like the Big Bang theory or the bouncing cosmology theory or the theories of, say, steady state universe or oscillating universe? And my answer is, well, you got me. There are lots of theories and they're really, really interesting. but they're actually physics questions. A better question for someone like me might be, so why was the universe created? That's a good question to ask a theologian. We're better trained to do the why questions than the how questions. But honestly, I don't mind having a hard question of either kind. Largely because they tend to take us deeper. Even if we don't arrive at a totally satisfying answer, there's benefit in exploring those kinds of questions. On the other hand, there are the trick questions. Now, trick questions are queries that aren't really about finding an answer. They're really about posturing, or tripping up, or attacking, or embarrassing, or in some way reducing that person who's being questioned. They're usually traps, and they're essentially theater. And Jesus, he got more than a few of those. In today's reading, Jesus is continuing his journey to Jerusalem. He's encountering and teaching all sorts of people, people with questions, who've got stuff, and surprising no one, because he's teaching the faith in a way that reinterprets and challenges what was commonly understood, there's some pushback. There are three identifiable groups in the Gospels who call Jesus out on his interpretation. First, there are the scribes, this group of Jewish leaders, legal scholars, who are learned in the law of Moses. They were people who were they were somewhere between my son, or at least who my son hopes to be, and me. The religious law and criminal and civil law, there was no difference in that time and place. It's all the same. So these were people, like me, who knew their Bibles. They studied theology. They had opinions on pretty much anything. They dressed up in fancy clothes. They were admired by many, highly respected, which in my case perhaps is a bit of a leap, but I do dress up in fancy clothes. But yes, Jesus found himself arguing with the scribes, the religious and legal scholars, with some regularity. Another group who were actually outgunning for Jesus, not all I should add, because some were actually supporters of Jesus, but another group who he found himself being challenged by were the Pharisees, who were a relatively small group of lay people who were committed to a very strict interpretation of the scriptures in their everyday life. And while they had a lot of support amongst the regular folks in Israel, many weren't averse to suggesting how you might want to observe your everyday life as well. There's lots of stories in the Gospels of Jesus and the Pharisees having a set to. The third group who were rather interested in taking on Jesus were the Sadducees, a small but powerful, wealthy, and politically connected group of religious aristocrats. They controlled the temple in Jerusalem, and they also controlled the Sanhedrin, which was a national council that decided on these religious and legal issues. And yes, the head of the Sanhedrin was just about always a Sadducee. Unlike the Pharisees, who not only accepted Torah, the first five books of the Bible, sometimes called the Pentateuch, the Pharisees not only took the Torah as authoritative, but they also included the oral law and the prophets. The Sadducees, on the other hand, only accepted Torah as law, as authoritative. And also, unlike the Pharisees, and unlike many others in Israel, they did not believe that there would be a day when God would act decisively, when God would make all things right, raising all of Israel and perhaps even the rest of humanity from the dead and create a new world for people to live in. No, the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. They were of the when you're dead school of thinking. So when they asked Jesus their question in our Bible reading this morning, it was purely a trick question. It was one that was designed to make Jesus look like a fool. Drawing on a passage from Deuteronomy about family responsibilities toward widows, they offer that truly awful and absurd shaggy dog type story about a most unfortunate woman who gets treated like some inheritable silverware and is passed on through all these seven brothers, none of whom seem to have much luck in the survival department. Like, if you're number six, you're getting a bit nervous, I would think. And she was probably waiting for death at this point. Anyway, they end up with this question. Gee, oh, Mr. Oh-So-Smart teacher, in the resurrection that we don't actually even believe in, whose wife will she be? So it's purely a gotcha story. It's a story designed to make Jesus look like a chump. Now, St. Luke does not record Jesus saying what I'm sure he said next. See, I think he replied, "You guys really are idiots, aren't you?" It didn't get recorded. That's just me. But Luke does remember Jesus pointing out to them that their thinking on this subject was impressively limited and deeply flawed. He essentially says that in the age of the resurrection, questions about who's married to whom, hey, they just won't even be questions. And more importantly, death, that thing that drives and shapes and often controls our lives in ways that we don't even fathom. Death, it'll no longer even be an issue to those who are raised. And it's true. Without death as part of life's equation, the way we live, well, everything would be different. Everything. He doesn't actually say that the raised will be angels, but like angels, life would just go on for those who have been raised. And then he goes back to the book of Exodus. Yes, that's one of the books of the Bible that the Sadducees held on to as authoritative. And I suspect with a wink, he says, you know, it actually does point to the resurrection. I mean, doesn't Moses, during that episode with the burning bush, doesn't Moses remember God saying, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob? Isn't that all present tense? Hey, they aren't yet raised from the dead, but they're alive with God. Tricky answer to a trick question. So here's my question for you today. What's so important about resurrection? About the resurrection? Tomorrow is Remembrance Day, and it's an important day in our country and in our community. It's a day when we take a moment to pause from the regular pattern of our daily living to remember those who sacrificed their lives in the service of our country. In the 11th month, on the 11th day of the 11th hour, we pause. And we pause to remember, and that's not complicated, because it's not really a complicated day. We're simply being asked to remember them. On the other hand, if we do take the time to remember, well, I find it takes us to complicated questions. For we will find ourselves once again in some way reflecting on the old enemy death, reflecting on our human finitude, that inevitable element of human existence that drives and shapes and controls our lives in ways we ever really acknowledge or understand. Human mortality and the sense of loss we experience related to death causes us terrible pain. And so it molds us in all sorts of ways. And some of those ways, at least in my experience and from my perspective, are not always very healthy. They're not always very good. But what if Jesus is right? What if in the reality of God, to him all of them are alive? That's the words, the phrase he uses. To him all of them are alive. Yes, we mourn our dead. I miss all sorts of people. I hate being apart from them. I mean, just try to start counting up all the people that you mourn. There's a lot. Here's the thing. A few chapters after this one, St. Luke remembers another story, a most mysterious event. A story about it being early one spring morning and some grieving women are coming to a tomb to care for the body of a friend in the way of their tradition and culture. And when they got to the tomb, it was announced to them that their dear friend and teacher, Jesus, once dead, had been raised. He had been resurrected. And because he'd been raised, it seems that others will be raised as well. My question to you is, what's so important about resurrection, about the resurrection? And I would answer it by saying, everything. For in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, we have been given notice that the Sadducees didn't quite have it right. That the old saw, when you're dead, isn't actually operative. No, even in the face of those difficult but good questions about suffering and evil so clearly present in the world, our pain is tempered. For in this place, anyway, we know we have hope. We have hope in a God who acted decisively in Jesus. And so all of them are alive. Oh yeah. We have hope. Thanks be to God. Amen.